Jazz United. I'm Nate Chenin, the editorial director at WBGO.
And this is Greg Bryant. I host Jazz After Hours on WBGO. And we like to get together to talk about what's going on in our music community, in addition to just what's on our minds. Nate, I'm not a betting man, but if I had to wager today, I think I know one thing that's on your mind.
I've got Newport on my mind, Greg. The Newport Jazz Festival.
Right.
This is the time of year that we would be, my family would be packing up and starting to make our plans to head up to Newport, Rhode Island. Sadly, the festival, like many other events, mm-hmm. is not happening in person this year.
Right.
But that doesn't mean you can't experience the Newport Jazz Festival in some form.
Absolutely. There's a great three-part series from the great folks of Jazz Night in America, and you worked on that too, Nate. A great retrospective through several generations. We've also got Newport Jazz Revival Radio coming out August 8th and 9th. That's going to have full sets of music from the Newport stages throughout the years. It's going to be really amazing. But right now, we want to talk some about how Newport has fared over the years. It's really been a taste maker. It's had its finger on the pulse of the music. And I got to ask you, man, about George Wein and just your associations with this festival, because I've never been, and you're just going to have to lay open the full table for me, man.
Well, I don't think people realize they were tuning into a 9-hour podcast, but first of all, Greg, I did not know until we started talking about this. I did not know that you had never been to Newport.
Yeah.
And it makes this year even more bittersweet to me, because mm-hmm. I'm happy to be talking about it with you.
Sure.
But man, I wish we could be hanging there.
And yeah.
It would have been, and it will be mm-hmm. someday. Cool to like show you around. The
yeah, man.
A bit, you know, you are in a similar position as so many jazz fans, mm-hmm. and exactly the same position I was in for, the first phase of my life as a jazz listener.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Newport is something that most of us encounter on record
yeah.
first.
Yeah.
And then kind of construct this imaginary experience in our minds. And it's interesting to me that this year we're all in that boat.
Mm-hmm.
Whether you've been to the festival dozens of times, or you've, been waiting and looking forward to that first time,
Yeah.
So I think this is a good opportunity for us to kick around that idea of, a Newport festival, Newport Jazz Festival of the mind.
Right.
And the legacy on record and on film. I think we can get to some interesting places.
Same here, man. Like you say, it's been a real touchstone and a tastemaker in popular culture and for our music. When did you first find out about Newport? What was your first Newport experience on record, even?
Well, I dare say that this is the main gateway for jazz listeners, but for me it was the album Ellington at Newport.
Absolutely.
I was probably about 12 mm-hmm. or 11 or 12 mm-hmm. thereabouts, and it came in the mail. It was a Columbia Jazz Masterpiece
yeah.
CD.
I remember those. Yeah.
And you put that album on and you read the liner notes, which mm-hmm. which describe the scene of the band, especially playing that epochal version of Diminuendo and Crescendo in Blue with,
ooh.
Paul Gonzalez on tenor.
Yes.
27 choruses.
That's right.
Each one more exciting than the last.
Yeah.
It's transporting, mm-hmm. right? It's, I definitely remember reading and listening and just hearing the energy of the crowd
mm-hmm.
and thinking like, wow. First of all, how cool would it be to have been there in that moment?
Right.
But then also, like, it felt like a dispatch from a world that I hoped I would someday come into contact with,
Yeah.
And how about you? I mean, you must have heard it at an early age.
I did, man. At 6 and 7 years old, it was a transformer in one hand and a record LP in another. And I remember the day I went to my grandfather's house, going through his records, and found Ellington at Newport. And I wasn't really into Duke Ellington at that point. I could get into Miles and some of the more electric stuff, maybe by Herbie, but I decided to take a chance on Duke. And the first side really didn't win me over. But just like you said, that diminuendo and crescendo in Blue, it blew me away. And then when I turned the record over and just the words that I could read, you know, going through those liner notes and seeing the picture of the woman up dancing, and that there was almost a riot in the crowd, that they had to hold Duke over and not let him leave, you know, that was a euphoria and an excitement that, you know, I wanted to be down with those folks when I got older.
Amen to that. We need to hear some of that.
Mm-hmm.
Let's drop in on some Paul Gonzalez. I don't know what chorus this is in the solo, but let's drop right into the middle of it here. So this is Duke Ellington, the Duke Ellington Orchestra, with Paul Gonzalez playing his butt off, Newport, Rhode Island, 1956.
Diminuendo and Crescendo in Blue from Duke Ellington featuring Paul Gonzalez. Wow, you could feel and hear that excitement. This is a good point, though, Nate. I wanted to ask you, you know, that was 1956. And 2 years earlier, you know, Newport Jazz Festival is birthed through a wide variety of circumstances. But I got to ask you about George Ween. He's your personal friend. You helped him to write his biography. Tell me a little bit about George and how he really came to be one of the creators of this great fest.
I met George shortly after I moved to New York. I was 22 and I was, you know, I was ambitious and I was hungry. I mean hungry.
Yeah.
And George saw that. I think, you know, he has a long history of recognizing sort of raw young talent.
Yes, he does.
You know? And so he had been trying unsuccessfully to get his life story into book form. So we got together and I spent really the next 3 years of my life just living that story.
That's amazing.
Devoted to
That's amazing, man. You
know, the history of the festival and his own experience as a producer and presenter. So yeah, it was a really important experience for me. You know, I sometimes refer to it as my graduate school. Because, you know, there were times when that's what it felt like.
Yeah.
And there are other times when it felt like something a little less elevated than that. You know, really rolling up my sleeves and just doing the work. But what I told him when he put me on the spot and said, why should I write a book, was that, you know, because of Newport, because of the Newport Jazz Festival, his life story was really in some ways the story of jazz's development in American culture in the second half of the 20th century. The thumbnail is that George Ween was a club owner in Boston. He had a club called Storyville that was active in the 50s and was a really important spot in New England. And one night, Elaine Lorillard, who was a socialite from Newport, Rhode Island, shows up and talks to him about how she had been wanting to start some kind of jazz series in Newport during the summer. And the Lorillards were really these kind of young movers and shakers in Newport society. You know, you can't really understate the way that Newport represents the kind of, you know, old moneyed aristocracy. You know, it's mansions, it's seersucker suits, it's yachts, you know, and that image was even more so in the 50s. I mean, it was it was a pretty starchy place. And so the idea of presenting jazz in this, you know, summer playground of of the American aristocracy, it was pretty incongruous mm-hmm. in 1954.
Right.
And it was not without its tensions, you know, mm-hmm. a lot of which had to do with the fact that there were African American musicians converging on this town. You know, what was that going to be like?
Sure.
At a time when, you know, they were not welcomed in the hotels.
Mm-hmm.
It was an interesting situation,
yeah,
to say the least.
Yeah, absolutely. And you think about, you know, before Newport, the images that we've talked about offline of jazz being in these seedy places, dark, smoky, film noir kind of settings, to the open air of a festival, that's a bit of a mind shift in, you know, where this music could be performed. You know, it wasn't just a night music, you know, and it wasn't just for dark, dank, cramped places. You know, it could
right.
exist, you know, on the festival stage or before thousands of appreciative fans. So hats off to George Wein and the Lorillards for even beginning this idea.
It's interesting how fast it takes off,
mm-hmm,
you know.
Mm-hmm.
That first year, 1954, was definitely a bit of an experiment.
Right.
The festival was held on the grounds of the Newport Casino, Newport Tennis Casino,
mm-hmm.
which is now the International Tennis Hall of Fame.
Right.
These, you know, very genteel, manicured grounds. You know, it's funny. I recently was reminded of the fact that when Billie Holiday performed at Newport
mm-hmm.
that first year, you know, you see pictures and she's standing there in this this evening gown and looking, you know, just entirely elegant,
yeah.
and she looks like she fits right into that,
mm-hmm.
you know, high society idea.
Sure.
But one of the songs she sang in her set was Strange Fruit.
Right.
And and I don't even know if people often stop to think about, you know, I mean, the legacy of that song is well documented, but the
mm-hmm.
idea that she, out of everything that she could have sung
right
on her first Newport Jazz Festival, on the first Newport Jazz
mm-hmm.
Festival, she stood on that stage in front of a bunch of, you know, wealthy white Americans
mm-hmm.
and sang Strange Fruit. I mean, that
right.
is, that cuts right to the heart of what Billie was about.
Absolutely. The melody of protest. Dizzy Gillespie did the same thing in 1957. It's preserved on his Newport set, Diz at Newport on Verve. He takes the tune Manteca and the opening intro in syncopation with the bass line. He sings and leads the band in the chant, "I'll never go back to Georgia. I'll never go back to Georgia." Identifying that the South was, you know, still a hotbed. It was a place that was uncomfortable, unwelcoming for these musicians that we're speaking about, and using Newport as that platform to tell people there's something else that you need to pay attention to, that there's a message in this music.
To me, it's really fascinating to think about how the Newport Jazz Festival board at the time
mm-hmm.
was assembled by George to really address these issues in a thoughtful way.
Right.
You know, it included John Hammond,
mm-hmm.
the producer at Columbia Records, who had signed Billie Holiday
mm-hmm.
And was a champion for equal rights, and Nat Hentoff, who was very outspoken, and then also Langston Hughes and Ralph Ellison. You know, and there were panel discussions that had to do not only with jazz's place in American culture, but also with issues of race in the music and
mm-hmm.
where that was headed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they were really self-conscious about the difference
mm-hmm.
that the festival could make.
Yes.
And, you know, it took a while, but the festival, I would argue, did make a difference.
I would agree. And I would think that not only hearing this music, but seeing this music for the festival goers, as well as folks who were miles removed from Newport, Rhode Island. They had a chance, their first chance perhaps, to see the festival as well as hear it in the 1960 movie Jazz on a Summer's Day, and that documented the 1958 Newport Jazz Festival. When you see that film, Nate, tell me just some of your general reactions. How did that help the culture? Did it hurt the culture? What are your general reflections about the movie?
You know, Jazz on a Summer's Day is, I think, rightly understood as one of the greatest music films ever made. Mm-hmm. It's certainly, you know, top three jazz documentary, I think. And part of what makes it so, of course, is just the glorious music that it features.
Right.
But there's also a really sophisticated visual language mm-hmm. to the film. It was directed by Bert Stern, who was a really noted fashion photographer. He was not a jazz fan. Mm-hmm. Bert Stern's signature on this movie was the way that he composed these shots, mm-hmm. you know? Mm-hmm. So as you watch Jazz on a Summer's Day, what you get are these very tight close-ups
right.
of people, you know, whether right. it's Louis Armstrong or Anita O'Day.
The style of the day. Yeah.
Yeah, you get that tight framing. Mm-hmm. He's often shooting into the stage lights,
sure.
which is kind of a no-no,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
And then another thing that he does, mm-hmm. Which, you know, I feel like it's easy to forget that this was really unusual at the time.
Right.
He spends a lot of time, a lot of film mm-hmm. shooting the audience.
Yes.
So,
yes.
you know, there's
painfully
all this incredible
so.
Action.
Painfully
all this incredible
so.
Action on stage and,
yeah.
And all
yeah.
you get this long panning shot of the
right.
people in the crowd.
What but,
how do you
but
feel
Nate,
about that?
But Nate, check this out. You don't stop Thelonious Monk playing Blue Monk with Henry Grimes and Roy Haynes for shots of sailboats.
Yeah, they, well, you know, so here's how I feel about that.
Okay.
I feel two ways.
All right.
Number one, I agree with you completely
mm-hmm.
because that is such precious footage,
yes.
right?
Yes.
Just the shot of, you know, Monk's got those bamboo sunglasses.
That's right. That's right.
So hip.
Mm-hmm. And you know he's feeling it because according to Miles, watch Monk's feet. If his feet are moving,
yeah.
it's on. Right. So you know it's a good show, you know?
Yes. I feel you on that.
Mm-hmm.
But my counter would be that, you know, as we said, the visual language of jazz on film mm-hmm. through the 40s and 50s
right.
had been a real sort of film noir aesthetic.
That's it.
You know,
mm-hmm.
sort of analogous to Herman Leonard's incredible photography. You know, black and white,
right.
smoke curling in a dark room, underground. You know, just that feeling of like, it's very hip, but it's also a little illicit, maybe.
Sure, sure.
And what Bert Stern did here is celebrate the setting of Newport.
Mm-hmm.
And so instead of that, you know, dark underground black and white vibe,
right.
you've got the antithesis.
That's
you've
it.
Got sailboats and seagulls.
Yeah.
you
yeah.
know. And even the way that the film opens, I think, is so cool.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you hear Bob Brookmeyer mm-hmm. on valve trombone and Jim Hall on guitar and Jimmy Giuffre on tenor saxophone, and they're playing The Train in the River.
Yeah.
And you see the reflection of the water and the colors sort of rippling on those reflections.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a very sort of modern art, abstract kind of image.
Right.
But it sets the tone for what we're about to experience, which is something that's very summery. It's
mm-hmm.
very open air.
Mm-hmm.
It's very sort of aspirational.
Yes.
In the way that, you know
yes.
what I mean? It's...
Mm-hmm.
There is a feeling of leisure and luxury
true.
That is associated with the festival
true.
And he really captures it in that film.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's not done in a museum type of way. It shows jazz as being, like you said, something to aspire to, but something that's fun, something that's holistic. You know, it's part of a greater experience. And I think that did a lot to lift the profile of the music, as you've already stated.
You know, we should note that Jazz on a Summer's Day has been restored by Kino Lorber.
Okay.
And this new print of the film premiered at the New York Film Festival, and it will be releasing to virtual cinemas starting August 12th.
I can't wait.
So, you know, we talk about having a virtual Newport experience. Mm-hmm. This is a very good way to do it. Mm-hmm. So on our show page, we will link to the Kino Lorber website where you can get that information.
Absolutely.
You know, Greg, mm-hmm. we talk about the Big Ten idea. Mm-hmm. We talk about jazz reaching into other areas.
Right.
And that really happened in the 60s, and it happened in a very big way in 1969.
Yes, it did.
And I know you have some feelings about that year.
I do. If forced to choose one Miles Davis period that's had the biggest impact on me as a musician, as a listener, it would have to be what's sometimes called the lost quintet of Miles Davis. Miles with Wayne Shorter and the rhythm section of Chick Corea, Dave Holland, and Jack DeJohnette. Well, for the 1969 festival, they were booked to play, but Wayne Shorter missed his only gig with Miles on that day. I think there was some huge traffic delay. And as Wayne finally gets to the festival grounds and is walking up the stairs, the band is coming off the stairs, and he shakes hands with Miles, who actually has his cash in hand. They do a little bit of a street handshake, if you will, and Miles leans over to him and just says, "I know." And they both smile and go about their business. But man, if you hear this set, Miles with no frontline partner, just the rhythm section, I swear he turns into the Incredible Hulk. It's just the most visceral Miles that you'll ever hear. And it's imprinted on my brain for folks that aren't necessarily, you know, the beginner Miles Davis listeners, but really want to go deeper into what he was about, especially during that crucial time. That Newport set is fire.
Miles runs the voodoo down. Mm-hmm. We got to hear some of that because what you're talking about, that Hulk transmogrification, it happens almost immediately. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like mm-hmm. they start into that groove and it's like, we're going.
Yep.
Let's do this.
Yep. Was the Incredible Hulk. Oh no, I'm sorry. Miles Davis there on trumpet for Miles Runs the Voodoo Down from his 1969 Newport set with Chick Corea, Dave Holland, and Jack DeJohnette. Something else happened really critical during that 1969 Newport Festival, Nate.
Yeah, you know, there's a photograph that I always think of mm-hmm. when I think of this moment. Mm-hmm. It's a really fantastic, iconic image by David Redfern. Mm-hmm. And it depicts Miles standing in the wings off the stage, and he's wearing those sunglasses, yep. and he's got a denim bell-bottom jumpsuit.
That's the one.
Yeah, it's just awesome. Uh-huh. And standing, just off of his elbow, partially obscured by the stage baffling, mm-hmm. is George Wein.
Yeah,
and the two of them are looking on stage, yeah. and I don't know who exactly they were watching, mm-hmm. but there's a good chance that it was Sly and the Family Stone.
That's right. That's right.
You know, that year, mm-hmm. there were a handful of bookings mm-hmm. by artists who, you know, were coming out of that, you know, the new sound. Mm-hmm. You know, it was a Woodstock generation on the rise.
Yeah.
There was the British invasion happening. Psychedelic rock was ascendant. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and this kind of transcendent funk.
Yep.
You know, all of that was happening. And Miles was very interested.
Yes, he was.
In those sounds, mm-hmm. both musically and sociologically, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. and I dare say commercially, you know,
yeah.
Miles was thinking about, okay, well, like, how do I reach more people with this music? You know, mm-hmm. I don't want to be a niche product.
Right.
I want to reach the people. Mm-hmm. So the influence of those sounds and that spirit, it's a catalyst for him, mm-hmm. you know, it sends him on that track. I think he was bending in that direction already, but
I do too.
You know, it really kind of sends him on the track that, of course, gives us Bitches Brew mm-hmm. and all of those incredible early 70s albums. You know, it's a major cornerstone of the jazz tradition.
Yeah.
You know, and it's been written, you know, for a while it was written out of the tradition mm-hmm. by some people, mm-hmm. but I think we now understand that music as really foundational in a certain way.
It really is. It really is. And again, that somebody like George Wein had his ear and his eye out for blending those two worlds, you know, inviting a band like Sly and courting that new audience, you know, maybe some of the same folks that would show up for a Woodstock, maybe. But just a couple of years later, there's a serious happening and disruption at the festival in 1971 that really kind of leaves Newport splintered, if I can say it that way.
Yeah, it's a pretty fascinating story, I think, because George flirted with the idea of, you know, presenting Led Zeppelin and, you know, presenting the Paul Butterfield Blues Band. And, you know, mm-hmm. Woodstock is remembered, of course, as a cultural touchstone, mm-hmm. but as a ticketed music event,
oh, man.
It was a disaster.
Yeah, it was.
It was a total disaster.
It was.
Mm-hmm. And so George had a team and he had the expertise. And he really had this wide open lane to move into that area mm-hmm. and make a killing. But he had very little feeling for that music.
Yeah.
He didn't want to be a rock promoter. Mm-hmm. He loved jazz.
Sure.
He loved presenting
sure.
it. He loved being in the thick of it. And so what he did for a little while was this kind of compromise mm-hmm. where if he could justify to himself having a rock band on the festival,
yeah.
there had to be some reason
uh-huh.
why it had a connection.
That's
you
right.
know? So
yeah.
Woodstock happens.
Right.
And then, you know, on the West Coast, we have Altamont, mm-hmm. which is this, you know, infamous disaster that ends in the death of a fan
mm.
you know, near the foot of the stage.
Yeah.
But after Altamont, communities were really risk averse.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they looked at a rock festival and they said, no, thank you.
Right.
We do not want to welcome this chaotic, turbulent energy into our town. And so in 1971, George puts together a festival and he says, all right, I'm not going to put rock bands on this festival.
Mm-hmm.
But I'll make a special exception for the Allman Brothers because, you know, they're a blues band that worships John Coltrane.
Yeah.
So the 1971 festival, it's people like Willie the Lion Smith and UB Blake
right.
and Duke Ellington
mm-hmm.
and Weather Report. But on the Sunday evening, it was a blues night.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, what was scheduled was the James Cotton Blues Band and Joe Turner.
Oh, yeah.
Eddie Cleanhead Vidson.
Mm-hmm.
T-Bone Walker.
Oh, wow.
B.B. King, yeah. Ray Charles, and the Allman Brothers.
Mm-hmm.
So that summer, all the rock festivals are basically canceled.
Yeah.
And the underground press catches wind that the Allmans are going to be playing Newport.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, well, you know, if you want to get your kicks, like, this is the place to be.
Okay.
So all of these sort of post-Woodstock music fans
mm-hmm.
gather on the hill outside the festival.
Right.
And, you know, they're not interested in buying a ticket and, you know, sitting in an orderly fashion for a music festival.
Yeah.
They want this experience.
Mm-hmm.
Let's just say there was a fair amount of recreational drugs
sure.
involved in that scene.
Absolutely.
And there was a spirit of freedom and maybe a little anarchy
mm-hmm.
in the air.
Yeah.
And what ends up happening is they storm the festival, they tear down the fences, they take over the stage.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they just shut the whole thing down. And the city of Newport, which has up to this point had its share of clashes with George and the festival,
right.
no longer is tolerant. And they say, you know, you need to get out of here.
Mm.
And that is what leads to the establishment of the Newport Jazz Festival New York in 1972.
Absolutely.
Which then later yields the JVC Jazz Festival
mm-hmm.
that you and I have both experienced.
Right, absolutely. Yeah, it's really interesting to think about, you know, just what was going on, you know, throughout the 70s into the 80s. You know, there's this divide between the pop culture and, well, for lack of a better term, the jazz culture. You know, folks
mm-hmm.
who are slightly more affluent, that can afford bigger ticket prices. It's not as much of a hit for them. with this growing youth and counterculture that wants music to be at the center of their life experience, but they can't often cough up the bucks, you know, or they're wanting to go to, you know, a Fillmore East or what have you, you know, a smaller room where they can actually afford to pay, you know, the cover charge. So jazz starts to become seen as this thing for the elite very gradually, you know, and not really a music of the populace.
Yeah, it's important to note, right, that when the festival moves to New York, it's no longer an event in a big field.
Right.
It becomes this smattering of concerts mm-hmm. in places like Avery Fisher Hall
yeah.
and Carnegie Hall and Radio City Music Hall.
True.
And so you gain something in that exchange, mm-hmm. but you also lose something.
Right.
And I think you're alluding to that, this idea of accessibility mm-hmm. and openness. You know, it becomes a much more formal presentation.
Mm-hmm.
And I think jazz culture benefited from that in certain ways, and it was also harmed by it in other ways.
True, true, absolutely. The JVC Festival that you mentioned in the early 2000s, you know, I remember, you know, saving up for a couple of months. You know, that was my senior year in college, you know, coming to New York, you know, finding a place to stay, but just enjoying the majesty of the Keith Jarrett Trio and Carnegie Hall. I'll never forget that. But like you say, you know, all of these premium bands in these premium rooms. Yeah, that's an experience you'll never forget. But if you want a good seat, be prepared to pay.
Right, right. Well, this is the thing, right? Newport is open. It is all about movement, mm-hmm. but you do have to be able to get into the gate.
Right.
So, you know, yeah. I mean, let's not confuse the matter. Mm-hmm. You know, Newport is a privilege,
mm-hmm.
And you know, I use that word with its multiple connotations.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a privileged environment,
yeah.
And I think when you're there, you're aware of that, but there's also a feeling of community.
Yeah.
And this is a thing that I've thought about a lot.
Mm-hmm.
The festival returned to Newport in 1981.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a period where it was a very commercial affair. There was one stage at Fort Adams State Park, which is an old Civil War fortification. And it's a beautiful setting.
Yeah.
But, you know, for a while, they were putting on this, you know, big ticket, big name festival that was, you know, broadcast on Japanese television. And it was, there was not a lot of room for experimentation
right.
or for new and up and coming sounds.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was pretty much a big stage for big names.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember when I was working with George on his book, there was a moment when he began to feel that he was missing something there.
Okay.
And he added a second stage.
Yeah.
Which then, you know, doubles the number of acts that you can put on, and it mm-hmm. and it does something else. It opens up the possibility of featuring an artist who jazz fans love, but who may not be a big commercial draw.
Right.
And then, you know, after that second stage, there was a third stage added,
mm-hmm.
and then there was another stage added. And so now you have this, you know, this multi-course meal
mm-hmm.
model.
Yeah.
And there's an interesting side effect that happens there. I have noticed that especially in the last 10 years or so, when you walk around the festival, and especially if you're able to, you know, peek backstage,
mm-hmm.
you will see musicians hanging out.
Yeah.
And checking each other
yeah.
out. And bringing their family, you know?
Right.
No matter how many different schools of playing or different styles are represented,
mm-hmm.
Different scenes.
Right.
The festival is now an atmosphere where people do feel like they're a part of this larger family,
mm-hmm.
you know, and they're checking each other out. They're, you know, running into each other.
Yes.
And it has that real sort of festive familial vibe.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, you know, to be honest, that's one of the things that I'm really going to miss this summer.
Wow.
That's always such a recharge for me, just to feel like I'm in the midst of that energy.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I know there have been some really special moments, especially over the last 10 years. I'm going to put you on the spot just a little bit because, again, I'm Newport Festival of the Mind fantasizing over here. If you had to name the most impactful sets that you've seen, that not only blew you out of the water as a fan, but were just surprising. You came to the festival and you heard this band, you heard this concept, and it was just a revelation for you.
I will say one of them would have to be the Ornette Coleman Quartet.
Wow. Okay.
And this was, you know, the band with DiNardo, his son, on drums, of course. Mm-hmm. But, you know, Ornette playing on that fourth stage and just the force of his sound. And I remember there was this one moment where he was playing in that piercing, humanistic sound that he had on alto saxophone. Mm-hmm. And the seagulls found something to like about that. And they started to answer him. And
you
heard this like quintessential Newport thing of, you know, Ornette Coleman's horn and the seagulls, you know, commingling in the air, you know. And and it was deep. It was great. Mm-hmm.
That's beautiful, man. You know, thanks for sharing.
Are there any that you wish you could have experienced? You know, like limiting it to, you know, the festival during your adult lifetime, you know? You know, let's say that there's no time machine here, but if you could have made it to the festival, what do you wish you could have heard?
Two sets come to mind. One, I believe, was where Herbie Hancock set in with the Wayne Shorter Quartet a couple of years ago. And then another was actually, I think, 2013, when Gregory Porter debuted at the Newport Festival, you know, kind of watching the trajectory of his career, seeing how hard he's worked and earned what he has now. That Newport victory, I'll call it that, had to have been really special to witness. And I remember trying to tune in to the actual NPR broadcast that year. But I was playing another festival actually on the West Coast, so I missed it altogether. But I would have loved to have been there for Gregory.
It was a good one, you know. And I can say you're right on the money. Gregory Porter at Newport, you know, he can turn any space into a sanctified space, especially those first couple of years when he was not on the big stage, but on the in the tent stage.
Okay.
You know, talk about a you know, like a tent revival.
yeah.
You know, the spirit moves whenever he performs, but it really did at Newport. And I think that he was energized by the intensity of the crowd's response. You know, it was good.
That's amazing.
But it, you know, it just reminds me that we've got to look forward, you know.
We do.
So much when we talk about Newport, there's all this glorious history. But I mean, I was looking forward to hanging with you at the festival this summer.
Same here.
And you know, drinking some Dell's lemonade and, you know, maybe having a lobster roll.
Sure.
It's going to happen. We're going to get you up there.
You will. You will indeed. 2021. Let's cross our fingers that we're back to normal.
next year in Newport.
Indeed. This is Jazz United, hosted by yours truly, Greg Bryant, and Nate Chenin. We're produced by Sarah Kirsten. Our senior producer is Simon Rentner, and also our theme music, United, is composed by Wayne Shorter, performed by Newark's own trumpeter, Woody Shaw.
You can find links to the music we featured on our show page. You can also find more information about the reissue of Jazz on a Summer's Day. Please subscribe to the podcast wherever you get your podcasts. We're on Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, on Stitcher. Thank you for joining us on this Newport Jazz Festival of the Mind. We hope to see you out in Newport, Rhode Island at some point in the near future.